Good morning and welcome to the August 5th, 2024 edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my guest co-host for the day, Catherine Bergener. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Well, we suggest you spend the next hour listening to us rather than obsessively checking the markets because they are way down this morning. We have some interesting stuff to share with you. We're going to start out the day by speaking with author Adam Pearson. He tells the sweet story of how his family created a chocolate business in Peru.
Then Steve Brozovic, the CEO of the Utah Symphony, will update us with developments of note. We will finish our hour with Devin Johnson, co-owner of the reimagined Hub restaurant in Heber.
All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned. Some entrepreneurial stories follow a somewhat linear path, from a business school project to a startup to a successful company. Others take a more winding road. One such story, one that literally involves winding roads in the wilds of Peru, is that of gourmet chocolate Fortunato. We're lucky this morning to be joined by Adam Pearson, one of the co-owners and the author of a fascinating new book, Finding Fortunato. Morning, Adam, and thanks for being here.
Hey, Roger, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the kind intro as well.
Okay, Adam, the Fortunato story, as I was reading the book, which was actually a lot of fun, it reminded me a bit of the lyrics from the classic Chumbawamba song, I Get Knocked Down, But I Get Up Again. Let's start with your father, who was a serial entrepreneur. Can you share a bit about him and his background?
Yeah, so my dad was born in Fort Wayne, Indiana in 1939, and he lost his father to Hodgkin's disease when my dad was only four. And my grandpa was a restaurant entrepreneur in Indiana. He owned a chain of four restaurants. And when he died, the rest of the family started looking at his son and putting the pressure on him and putting expectations on him to become an entrepreneur who was as successful as his father. Sort of a strange burden for a four-year-old to have to carry around. But that was, you know, that's what people expected from him starting at a young age. And so in the 70s, he started one of the world's first cattle investment funds, and he was making, you know, he was making big money. And then the inflation of the 70s hit, and Reagan froze the price of cattle without freezing the price of feed. And my dad's cattle fund started losing $1 million a month, and that went under. And then he took a trip around the world. And when he came back from India, He lived in San Diego, and he built a hotel called the Horton Grand Hotel, which is still in downtown San Diego. He was one of the first real estate developers to build in downtown. And we owned a hotel from when I was born until I was 12. And then he had this crooked investor who ended up stealing the hotel from us. So when I was 12, my dad declared bankruptcy. And so during my teenage years, I had to watch my dad go through 7 years of really hard depression and bankruptcy. And when he came out of his depression, he and my brother decided to start a business. So you talk about the winding road. They stumbled across this technology for air filter cleaners. And the market for the air filter cleaners was big mines, because they have big machines, and these air filter cleaners were going to clean the air filters in these big trucks. So we ended up getting a contract with the world's biggest gold mine at the time, which was in Peru. And so we worked that for several years, and then we really didn't like the way that mine was doing business in the community, but there was a contract at the mine with the cafeteria to buy bananas. So we went out into the jungle to try to buy bananas. And then while we were out there looking at bananas, we became interested in cacao, and we accidentally found out that we had stumbled across a variety of cacao that was thought to be extinct. And my dad was the one pushing that the whole time. And he's, you know, I've seen him go through it all, and he's always been extremely optimistic and always chasing what the next goal was without getting down and fretting too much about the struggles that he's been through.
I loved your father's saying, and I'm paraphrasing, if you don't quit, you can't fail. And that really stuck out to me. You could probably say his saying better than I can, but your own story has its own elements of challenge. How did you come to realize you had the entrepreneurial bug?
So I was just to quickly mention what you said about my dad, about the if you don't quit, you never fail, because that'll lead into the answer to your second question.
I thought those, so.
Yeah, so you know, those words are real easy to say, Mm-hmm. It sounds so nice coming off the tongues, off your tongue. If you don't quit, you'll never fail. But to actually see what that means in real life, to see my dad really fail hard but not ever give up, rubbed off on me. Like I said, I grew up the son of a hotel owner, so I was a terrible student in school. I was smart, but disruptive. It's kind of hard to get really excited about sitting at a desk and do paperwork when your dad owns a hotel. So I struggled with that. At the time when my dad and my brother were starting our business with the mining company, I took a job doing payroll with the Department of Defense, which is just about the least entrepreneurial job you can have. So I was working in this huge field of cubicles every day, and that was my first attempt at having a real, you know, quote unquote, real job. And that really is when I realized that this probably isn't cut out for me, and that I need to go for it. When I quit the job with the Department of Defense and went to work for the chocolate company, my dad was only paying me like $1,500 bucks a month, and I was a young married man with a family to support, and the only way I could make ends meet was selling enough chocolate to pay the bills. And that suited me quite nicely. So the Department of Defense was out, and living off the chocolate I could sell was in, and I've been doing that ever since.
One of the really enjoyable things about the book is your ability to tell stories. And this story of your father and your brother sitting around thinking, wow, what technology can we find? What can we do to try to make some money? And stumbling upon this sort of air filter technology and then asking, well, where might we sell it? Can you talk a little more about the story of how they end up going to Peru, of all places, and how they work their way into selling to the mining company?
Yeah, so, you know, when you've been burned the way that my dad got burned in his hotel venture, where he had a rich investor who went behind his back and bought the mortgage from the bank, which was a breach of fiduciary duty, and they went to court 30 times, and my dad kept winning in court, but the guy had deep pockets and he kept appealing until my dad ran out of money. So my dad, and what it has since that time, has been dead set on our family not having any outside investors and not entering into any kind of agreements where we could get screwed over. So the thing about that air filter technology was they went and negotiated with, and then the air filter thing ended up being a moot point anyways, but it was a technology where we had exclusive selling rights to any mines we could bring on board, and we had no experience whatsoever selling anything to mines. We were not in the mining industry. We'd never heard of Peru. We couldn't point out Peru on a map. We just went out and started telling everybody we knew that we were selling this stuff, and we just started asking everybody we knew if they knew anybody who worked at a mine. And that's a good entrepreneurial tip for anybody who's trying to start a business. I think a lot of people start businesses sort of in secret, and they're maybe a little shy about telling people what they're up to. But that's probably the exact opposite of what you want to do. You want to just tell everybody what you're doing, put it out to your network, talk as much about it as you can, because you might make a good contact. So turns out my dad's best friend knew a guy who worked at the world's biggest gold mine in Peru. And they set up a call. We pitched the air filter idea. My dad flew down to Peru for the first time. And then where we were doing business is in this tiny little city way deep in the northern Andes Mountains, where there just happens to be huge gold deposits. And my dad went out there and pitched the air filter idea to the mine. And they told us, no, they were not. They didn't want the air. They did. So after, you know, we researched this project, we researched this technology for a year, and in 15 minutes, in the very first meeting, the guy said, "Nah." The maintenance supervisor said, "No, we don't want the air filter cleaners, but we're buying a whole bunch of parts from Caterpillar, and we know they're price gouging us, but there's no other distributors of these parts in this country. So if you want to do business with us, instead of the air filters, here's a whole list of parts that if you could bring them in and sell them cheaper than Caterpillar, we'll buy them from you instead of Caterpillar." And my dad jumped on that. And then he and my brother came back to the United States and started flying around the country talking to manufacturers of nuts and bolts and hydraulic hoses. And we submitted our price bid. And then, you know, 6 months after that first meeting, we received a contract for $6 million. Of hydraulic hoses and nuts and bolts at the world's biggest gold mine. So, you know, that's another thing about entrepreneurship. It's It's like the Chumbawamba song you said about you get knocked down, but you get back up again. It's all the process of discovery as well. So if you just give up after you get knocked down, you're not going to discover the thing that could actually be viable. So you kind of have to keep going because you don't know what you don't know. So that's how we ended up in Peru. And while we were doing the mining business, both my brother and I married Peruvian women. And we have kids with our wives, and, you know, we're a Peruvian American family now.
So how did the idea of chocolate come to your family?
Yeah, here's exactly how it happened. We were doing business with the mine. And so the mine is at 14,000 feet above sea level. And it was cold and windy, and my brother was the one who I was kind of doing the administration, but my brother was the one who had to go up to the mine every day, and he did that for 4 years, and that required waking up at 4 a.m., getting on chartered buses. So the mine had these chartered buses that took all of the employees up to the mine. 2-hour bus ride from the city up through the hills and the mountains. You look out at the countryside, you see all these country farmers living out there in the mountains on their land. And he did that for 4 years, and he got really burnt out on having to go up to the mine every day. In addition, the mine, which is, it's Newmont Mining Corporation out of Colorado, the mine was not doing so great in the community. There was a lot of suspicion that they were, like, poisoning, contaminating the water. And we were just kind of getting burnt out on it. So the mine had a contract to buy fruits and vegetables for the cafeteria, because when a lot of the mining employees go out to the mine, they stay out there for 4 or 5 days at a time, and they have to eat. They couldn't find anybody in the town of Cajamarca who was willing to go east of the Andes Mountains and down into the jungle, because the jungle feels very, even to Peruvians, when you live in the mountains, the jungle feels very hot and wild and exotic. And the closest agricultural zone where you could buy bananas in that part of Peru was also known to be controlled by the mafia, and the people got kidnapped and stuff. It felt dangerous. And my brother is an adventurer, and he said, you know what, I'd rather go to the jungle and have an adventure than keep going up to this mine to sell hydraulic hoses and nuts and bolts. So he signed up for that. And while we were looking at bananas are the shade trees for cacao. So cacao is the fruit that you use to make chocolate. Have you guys ever seen cacao pods before?
I have not.
Only in the movies.
So they look like football-shaped squashes, and they hang from trees. And when you cut them open, there's 30 to 40 seeds on the inside. And those seeds are covered in this sugary white gel called a mucilage. And the sugary gel allows you to ferment cocoa beans. The seeds don't taste anything like chocolate when you eat them straight out of the pod. But after you ferment them for 7 days, that is what makes chocolate taste like chocolate. So chocolate's made from these seeds. We didn't know any of this. But those trees always grow next to bananas, because bananas have these wide drooping leaves that are great for shade. Like, you've heard of shade grown coffee, maybe. Mm-hmm. Those are usually grown underneath banana trees, because bananas give good shade. So we just got really fascinated with cacao, and it seemed more interesting than doing business with the mine. And so we started investigating the market. And one thing that all of the companies we were talking about selling cacao to were asking us is, what is the genetic variety of this cacao? Because cacao has different genetic varieties the same way grapes have different genetic varieties. And each genetic variety, like Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, Shiraz, et cetera, has its own flavor profile. That's the same with cacao and chocolate. A lot of people don't realize that single origin chocolates vary in flavor from place to place. So the people we were trying to sell cacao and chocolate to were asking us, what is the genetic variety of this cacao? And we had no idea. I mean, we were total neophytes. We didn't know what we were talking about at all. So my dad, on a whim, cold called the USDA genetics testing lab in Beltsville, Maryland. And it turned out that the fellow who worked there was this good old boy from Missouri, and my dad's from Fort Wayne, Indiana. And they just started chatting, and they became like bosom buddies. Just luck. The book's called Finding Fortunato. So that was just luck. And they became great friends, and my dad told them, look, we're doing business in northern Peru. We came across this cacao. We need to know what the genetics are. Can you help us? And the guy said, yeah, we will help you out. So what you have to do to test the genetics on cacao is you have to send in leaf samples. So we sent in all these leaf samples from a bunch of different regions where we were looking at bananas. And when the results came back, they told us that the cacao that was grown on the farm of this one guy named Fortunato Colala, who's a cacao farmer, that he told us that was a thought to be extinct variety of cacao called Pure Nacional. It was thought to only grow in Ecuador, mostly at the beginning of the 1900s. And it was during its time, it was considered to be the finest flavor cacao in the world. It was the cacao that was used in all the high-end chocolates in Europe in the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s. But it was thought to have been wiped out by a disease that attacks cacao called witch's broom. And it was not known to exist anymore. So we rediscovered this thought to be extinct variety of cacao. And when we got that news, that is when we decided to take all of our savings, which is my dad's life savings. And he was 69 at this time. You know, he'd cycled through all these businesses. He was 69. He had a little nest egg built up from the mining business. And he said, we're going to go all in on the chocolate business. And so he started spending his life savings on building a cacao processing facility out in the jungle, which we own and operate to this day.
The early stories of your brother setting up a manufacturing facility are pretty amazing. Not exactly sort of luxury living.
No, not at all. We got the story in this book about my brother's first night out in the jungle, which maybe you remember, but out in that part of the jungle, there's not like rental houses. It's all you build a house to live in it. It's not like anybody, have passive income or something like this. My brother moved out to this abandoned house that had a terrible roach infestation. And it's in the book. It's a good story. You know, it came out really nicely. And he didn't have his bed yet. And he had a mattress on the floor covered by a mosquito net. And you always got to have a mosquito net when you sleep out in that part of the jungle because the mosquitoes just eat you alive. And he's laying on the mattress inside a mosquito net. And all of a sudden, he starts hearing a thousand little footsteps on the floor all around him. And he had a headlamp inside his mosquito that he puts it on. And there's just a sea of cockroaches covering every square inch of the floor. And I moved out there and lived in the jungle with my wife, and we lived in a house with a rat infestation. It's just any structure that is not occupied by human beings and is not maintained will become home to other living creatures. And that's where all of our food comes from. I mean, that's where most of our food comes from. Not just chocolate, but most of the food that we eat and consume comes from remote places because you need enough space to grow all the food that we eat. Each human being needs about an acre of land to grow all the food that we eat in a year. So if you have millions and millions or billions of people, that's billions of acres of remote farmland. And you know who lives out there? Like creepy crawly rats and roaches and all kinds of weird bugs you can think about. And so if you're in the business of buying cacao to make chocolate, then that's what you have to deal with. And that's what we've been doing for the last 16 years. And the lesson from that is gratitude. Chocolate comes in a real fancy box, and highly trained European chefs can make it look real pretty. But when you trace it back, there's people living in rooms with roaches and working under the hot jungle sun with machetes, cutting it down. And it's just, it only becomes fancy at the very end. And that's true of most of the food that we eat.
Wow. What does the company do today? And how can our listeners try your chocolate?
Please check us out at www.fortunatochocolate.com. And the book Finding Fortunato is available on Amazon, which tells this whole story from beginning to end. And everything you ever wanted to know about chocolate and where it comes from and entrepreneurship and everything. I mean, I think it's all in that book. From 2009 to 2020, we were entirely a wholesale business selling chocolate mostly in Europe to high-end restaurants and chocolatiers who would then use our chocolate to make their confections. When COVID hit 2020 and restaurants and chocolatiers were shut down, we pivoted into an e-commerce direct-to-customer model here in the United States. So we almost went out of business in 2020, but we managed to pivot. You know, if you don't quit, you never lose. So we managed to pivot and stay in business, and it's been a whole new chapter for us. So now we're doing e-commerce, and then we've also opened up two retail locations here in the Pacific Northwest. But if people want to try chocolate made with one of the really, truly best varieties of cacao that you can get, it's at fortunadochocolate.com, and we've been making these recipes for 16 years now.
Just briefly, I want to go back because I think I skipped something. Tell us a little bit about what happens from the bean to the table, you know, the process of making the gourmet chocolate.
Absolutely. So like I said before, first you have to cut the fruit down from the tree, and then you got to break the pod open, and the thickness of the husk is similar to a squash or a pumpkin. And then inside the husk, you have 30 to 40 seeds, which are about the size of grapes. So you have to scrape those into buckets. And then we have a buying team we buy from about 500 small cacao farms in northern Peru. And we pay premiums on average of 10 times fair trade premiums because we cut out all the middlemen and we do all this direct. So you scrape the seeds out of the pods into buckets. And then we have trucks that drive on these muddy jungle roads out to these 500 farms. It rains all the time during the cacao harvest. It's 100 degrees and raining all the time for 8 months of the year out in that part of the world. So we're out there doing sweaty, hard work on these farms, cutting down cacao pods. And then you load it all into pickup trucks and you drive it down these dirt roads back to our centralized cacao processing facility. And then you dump the seeds into wooden boxes and then you cover them. And what happens, when the seeds and the sugary gel are exposed to the environment, environmental yeast falls on them. And then when you cut off oxygen, yeast and sugar interact to kick off fermentation. And that's how alcohol is made, and that's how vinegar is created. And it just so happens, it's weird that human beings are even able to figure this out because it's totally not intuitive. when you ferment these cacao seeds, they start to smell like chocolate. That's how you create the chocolate flavor, is by fermentation. And how you ferment cacao matters. If you under ferment it, it's real acidic. If you over ferment it, you spoiled. And that was one of the things that my brother had to work for years to really perfect. So you ferment the cacao, then you dry it under the sun. A lot of the world's cacao is just dried on a road, or dried on the floor next to a road where exhaust fumes from cars and dogs and chickens and cats get all over it. And then you end up eating it. Sorry. So we do raised dryer tables where the cacao gets good air ventilation. And then, after 7 days of drying on the sun, then we pack it into burlap sacks, jute bags. And once we have 13 tons of cacao, we drive it out of the jungle over and through the Andes Mountains and then down the Peruvian coast to the capital city of Lima. That's a 20-hour, freight truck ride over and through the mountains. Then it's going on a boat, and from the port of Lima, it goes up the Pacific coast of Peru through the Panama Canal, due east across the Atlantic, through the English Channel into the North Sea to the port of Rotterdam in the Netherlands, then south from Netherlands into the Swiss Alps to Switzerland. And we have our chocolate made at the preeminent chocolate making factory in the world. It's called Max Falkland AG. They've been around for 130 years. They make these 1.1 pound blocks of chocolate for us. And what happens there is you roast the cocoa beans and then you grind them. Cacao is half vegetable fat. So when you grind it over heat, it liquefies. While it's in its liquid state, you add sugar. And then when you cool it in molds, the fat congeals and hardens. And then that liquid mixture hardens into a chocolate bar. Then we ship it back here to the United States. So it's going back across the Atlantic to the Port of Houston, on a truck across the western part of the United States here to the Seattle area. And then we melt down that chocolate to make all of our confections. And then we also just sell the chocolate straight. And that's the whole process from beginning to end. And then we can ship it right to your house.
Wow. It sounds like a lot.
It's a lot. It's complex.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. I wish we had more time because I loved your book and would love to hear. I'm sure our listeners would love to hear more. But thank you for being here.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me. And have a great rest of your day.
You too.
All right, bye.
Amidst the current conversation about sports and new professional sports franchises, Utahns can take pride in the fact that The Utah Symphony is also a major league team that is part of what makes the state special. Musicians have each prevailed through grueling auditions against hundreds of other musicians to achieve a spot on the team. And collectively, they form the foundation of music and music education across our state. Our next guest, Steve Brozovic, is the CEO of the Utah Symphony. Welcome, Steve.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You have so much to tell us about, Steve. What are the key challenges facing the symphony right now?
It's a great question, and it's always a changing landscape every year. Our key challenges at the moment are really finding our next music director to succeed Terry Fisher, who is our principal conductor and artistic director for 14 seasons, and that search is rolling along nicely. And that person is going to be the next person who will take the artistic helm and guide the organization for the next decade or so. And also, as we're looking at, you know, who we are creatively and artistically, because it's such a fantastic orchestra, we also are looking at these big questions, which you just noted in the entry, is the sports and entertainment zone with our sports teams, and what will be, where will we be performing if there's changes in the sports and entertainment district. Which is a sports, entertainment, culture, and convention district. And also just resolving our financial questions. We're a nonprofit organization, and every year is a financial struggle for us to balance providing access to what we do every year, but also increasing costs. So it's always a question, but at the end of the week when we have performances for our audience members and education programs that serve so many Utahns, we're proud of the work that we're doing.
I want to flesh out both of those issues, and let's start with the Sports and Entertainment District. At one point, one of the proposals on the table involved actually tearing down or moving Bravenel Hall. Where do things stand now on that?
It's a great question, and I think that is shifting all the time. I think the focus at the moment, certainly on our part in working with all of our public officials and with SEG, is to really take a careful look at how can a Bravenel Hall continue to be a Bravenel Hall, work on the renovations that we've already been discussing with Salt Lake County, who is the owner and operator of the building, to really rethink that renovation, but to keep the concert hall and to find a way for a Bravenel Hall to really actively engage in a really intrinsic way with this new sports and entertainment zone, because we all agree that having Utah Museum of Contemporary Art, which is our neighbor, and Utah Symphony, Utah Opera, as part of this district is really what makes it unique across the country. Having the arts and the culture and sports and the convention district together is really different and could be a really dynamic combination.
As a business show, I also want to follow up on the second issue. I don't think many people really understand the fundamental finances of an organization like the Utah Symphony. We know that we pay for tickets. That's one source of revenue. Can you talk about both the major sources of revenue? For example, what percentage of your overall budget in terms of income comes from ticket sales versus donations, and your outflows? What are you paying out? What kinds of programs are costing you?
Absolutely. We have always been a high fixed cost organization, as every organization like us is worldwide. We are one of only 17 fully professional orchestras in the country. We are one of only 6 fully producing opera companies in the country, and we're truly a unique organization in North America. And with that comes highly talented musicians, a great staff, and that comes at a price. We are, you know, we're a fraction of the cost of a sports team, but all of the same dynamics are there. We're a $28 million expense organization on an annual basis. Only 30 to 35% of our income comes from ticket sales, and that is pretty standard across the industry, across the United States. Some orchestras do a lot better. We, frankly, have recovered quite well coming out of the pandemic, much better than many of our colleagues across the country. And we attribute a lot of that is with the support of Utahns and the fact that we were able to find a way to continue performing live throughout the pandemic. And just more people stayed with us, and it was really fantastic support. So after that 30 to 35% of ticket sales income, we have to find the rest. And we have a core of really wonderful supporters who then individually step up. Financially, corporations are sponsoring. We get a lot of great support from the state of Utah, which helps support primarily our education programs, because we have one of the largest education programs in the country. Last year, we served about 110,000 students and teachers. And we really take the Utah in our name seriously. We are making sure that we are serving Utahns, and in particular through those education programs, moving the orchestra around the state every single season. And every few years, we have an incredible state tour, which are outdoor concerts, started at all of the national parks, but is now really focusing primarily on communities in our 83 years of history that we haven't been to yet. We want to make sure that we're serving the whole state, and thankfully that garners a lot of support. But as I mentioned, inflation is you know, hitting us like it has everyone, and we need additional support from new subscribers and new ticket buyers.
Let's talk about the special partnership with Deer Valley Concert Series. This is the final week of the 20th anniversary of the Deer Valley Music Festival. What has the symphony lined up for us?
We have had a really great summer, and it is 20 years of the music festival that we started back in 1984. I'm sorry, in 2004, but we've been performing in Park City actually way back into 1984. So we've been part of Park City for a long time. Coming up still this week, which is actually the last week of this year's music festival for our concerts, and then Deer Valley has their own separate series that they will continue with. But performances with the orchestra as part of the Deer Valley Music Festival will wrap up this week. We have a John Williams performance, music of all John Williams. And this particular performance, he won't be here with us, but Mr. Williams has curated this entire concert, this whole list of repertoire from his films. And we're really excited to have this particular performance of his music up there. And then we will close being joined by the singer-songwriter Cody Fry. To say he's young and up and coming would actually not be true. He's young, but has an extraordinary career and is going to draw on a whole new audience for us. And I think everybody who's used to coming to the symphony is going to have a great opportunity to hear somebody new who they might not know, with hearing the orchestra really as a highlight feature of this performance. And that closes out the season for this year.
And let's talk about the upcoming season. I understand Yo-Yo Ma is coming.
Yo-Yo Ma is coming, and this will be the first time that he has been here performing with us since the Olympics in 2002. So we are thrilled that we are able to get a date with him. He's going to be with us in December, and it's a one-night-only performance. There are only a few individual tickets left, so if you haven't checked our website to get one, please do it before there's nothing left. But it's an extraordinary performance. You can't get Yo-Yo Ma to come all the time because he is under constant demand, and he wanted to come back, and we finally found a date that works with our schedule and his schedule. He'll be performing Dvorak's cello concerto with us.
And other highlights for the coming season?
There are so many. One of the really interesting things that we're doing, actually, we're kicking off this season in September in a different way than we ever have. We have, for a number of years now, had a traditional opening of our main concerts, our masterwork season, a classical performance to open the season. And then we've separately had a performance that we've called Celebración Sinfónica, which is our kind of tribute to Hispanic Heritage Month. And this year we decided, instead of having separate performances, what we wanted to do is really bring everybody together. So we are combining those two programs, and we have a lot of Latin American influenced music on this program to open our season in September, and pulling those audiences together because Utah is one community, and we really want to bring everyone together, and we're going to give this a try, and we're really excited about it. That's one of the things that we're really, really thrilled by. And then we're closing the season with our former music director, Terry Fisher, coming back as music director emeritus. And we're closing the season a little bit later than we normally would in June. And that's because we wanted those performances to align with a national conference of the League of American Orchestras. We anticipate 1,000 to 1,200 of our colleagues from all across the country coming here. We're hosting the conference. It's never been here before. The League of American Orchestras has hundreds of orchestras as member orchestras. And we're going to bring them all here, and we're going to highlight Utah. We're going to highlight the Utah Symphony, Utah Opera, and really show the rest of the music world who we are.
You mentioned in our communications that you have lots of fun stories about your experiences with the symphony. We'd love to hear your favorite one.
Oh, okay.
A tough question. Sorry about that.
That is a very tough question. I just got to think about what the best one is to tell. Best fun story.
While you're thinking about it,
I can tell on the radio. Yep, keep going. I'll come back to it.
We can come back to it. Can you give us some highlights from the coming year's opera programs?
Absolutely. We do four fully staged opera productions every year. And this year, we have a really broad program, and we're really focused on highlights. We are bringing back, say, in January, we have Hansel and Gretel. Every January, we try to focus on an opera that is family-friendly, something that is going to be enjoyable for all generations. In March, we're bringing one of the absolute classics, Pagliacci, which is one everybody will be well aware and will know the key arias in that piece. And we're closing the season with a new production of Madame Butterfly. Madame Butterfly is one of the most popular operas in the repertoire. It always had some issues. It was written by Europeans who had an image of what they thought Asia was like. And we've been able to work with three other opera companies across the country and create a new production of Madame Butterfly, which uses all of the music that everybody knows, so everyone will recognize it. But everybody in the design team, the director, the lighting designer, the costume designer, they are all Japanese or Japanese Americans. So are able to bring some authenticity to a piece that everybody loves and tell the story in the same way, but really highlight the main character more than you're used to seeing. And we're really proud of this piece, and it's vibrant, and it's going to be so exciting, and we're thrilled to have everybody come and see it.
I understand that I think most, if not all, of the symphony members are here in Utah all the time. Tell us about the opera company. Are those all local people except for the sort of soloists that you bring in?
Yes, in large part, absolutely. First and foremost, from the first performances of Utah Opera, decades before the merger, it has always been the Utah Symphony performing in the pit for Utah Opera Productions, and that continues. The opera chorus, they're all locals. Everybody lives here. And we have a resident artist company of five musicians, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, four singers, and a pianist, who are with us, and they perform in all of our opera productions. And then most of the primary cast, we fly in from all over the world for the lead roles.
So did you think of a story that you can tell us that, let's try one that's just family friendly and it doesn't have to be your favorite.
This is a fun one, and it kind of tells you a little bit about, there's a whole range of guest artists in the world, and some of them, we like to work with the people who are extraordinary artists but are also incredible people, and those are the people that we like to bring. And I'm going to tell a story from a prior location where I was working a number of years ago, and that, you know, there's all kinds of stories about, you know, artists who have very special requests in their, we call it a concert writer, kind of the requirements of what they need to come and perform. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes they'll hide little tidbits of really crazy requests in that concert writer. And in some ways we've figured out that it's really just to make sure everyone is actually reading it all the way through, so you get all the really important things. You know, there's always a story that, you know, this artist wants a bowl of green M&Ms in their dressing room. this person wants carrots and ginger cut in a particular way. And there's a particular artist who had an 83-page concert rider.
Oh, my goodness.
By the end of the week, the entire staff was so fed up. The audience had a great time. Let me start there. Performances were great. Audience had a great time. But it was so difficult for the staff and everybody involved on the backside of it that we swore we were never going to work with that artist again. And the fun part of the story was at the end, the way that we could pull everybody back together and get through it was one of the people on the staff threw a party at their home with a bonfire, and everybody got to take pages of the concert writer and throw them into the fire.
Before we go, can you describe...
No, go ahead, please.
Before we go, can you describe a little bit about the kinds of subscriptions that are available for those who want to, you know, participate in next season's concerts, and about your website and how people can learn more?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a variety of subscription packages, everything from if you want to buy all four operas or all 18 weeks of our Masterworks season, to our film series, which is 5 weeks, our pop series, which is 4 weeks, or our family series, which is 3 weeks. So you can buy either those full packages or some smaller subsets if you want 9 or 6 or 4. And we also have a really great option, which is a kind of, we call it a choose your own package, where you can say, I want to purchase 3 weeks, 4 weeks a year, and you then get to go through the whole roster of the season and pull together the season that works for you. And if you come up on a date that isn't going to work for you, something gets in the way of your calendar, etc., as a subscriber, you can always call us and we can move your tickets around to another date. So there's a lot of incredible flexibility. So we really hope that people will dive in and grab a subscription package. It's a really fun season full of lots of well-known popular works. And I would really encourage everybody to take a look at the variety of what we offer, because I think if you aren't attending Utah Symphony or Utah Opera performances, take a look at what we offer, because we actually surprise a lot of people with the variety of performances that we have every season. And you can check all of it out on our website, which is Utah Symphony or UtahOpera.org.
Great. Is the symphony ticket packages, are they similar to the opera packages, where you can pick your own season, so to speak?
Yes, we have a lot of flexibility with all of them, and you can even mix and match between.
Oh, okay, that's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Steve, and we appreciate your time, and thanks for joining Mountain Money.
Great, thank you for having me on and giving me the opportunity to talk about what we do.
The Hub has been a Main Street staple in Heber City since 1933. The restaurant has recently reopened after a major remodel. Here to tell us more is one of the owners, Devin Johnson. Hello, Devin.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. How is the Hub important to the business community in Heber?
Well, we provide a lot of great lunches for business meetings, I guess. You know, the Hub's been an integral part, I would just say, of the community in general for a long time. You'd be hard-pressed to probably throw a rock in town and not hit someone whose family member, friend, cousin, aunt, uncle, you know, doesn't have a story growing up there. So whether it's from an employment standpoint, contributing to the economy from a payroll perspective, providing a place to, you know, gather with friends, families, colleagues, coworkers, you know, lunch meetings, what have you. I think it's a contributor to the valley in a way outside of just, you know, a business setting. At least we hope we are.
Well, let's take it back a little bit. Tell us a little bit about your background and how did you end up getting involved with Mohammed and the Hub?
Oh, wow. That's a long story. The short version is I buy too much Diet Coke.
at the convenience store?
That's right. Okay. That's right. I had a little ranch. I've got a little ranch up the canyon there. And I live down by Deer Creek, and I was always driving up Lake Creek to the ranch, and I was always, you know, topping off my caffeine fix, and one day, you know, he essentially said, "You want to buy a gas station?" I said, "Absolutely not." And that conversation, you know, turned into, you know, we already had a friendship, but that continued to grow, and so we continued to work together, and I, you know, kind of helped solve some problems the company was facing, and we've worked together ever since. And shortly thereafter, you know, we did a little bit of a remodel of the one stop there, and it took a while to talk the previous owner into you know, letting us sort of take on the mantle. But eventually, that conversation matured, and we ended up purchasing the Hub. And
to take it back a second, we're talking about the intersection of what of Interstate 40 and the route you take to the airport. There's a gas station and a convenience store there.
Yeah, Big Green Dinosaur out front. That's
and it's
right.
been there. It's been there for a long time. And so Muhammad was the owner of that building, and that's who you got to know well. And the Hub is next door.
That's right. I bought the one stop. Muhammad and I sort of refinanced it, purchased it from a cousin slash uncle that he had, and that was about 5 or 6 years ago, I believe. And then we acquired the Hub. I think it's been about 2 years now or so.
Was there anything specific that made you decide to join the ownership of the business?
The one stop or the Hub or both?
Yes.
Both.
You know, my day job, I had previously sold a company, and I was looking to kind of, you know, put some roots in the soil, and I felt very optimistic about the valley there, the people. So from an investment standpoint, I felt like it was safe. I didn't really think it was going to be a big moneymaker per se, but I really liked Muhammad. I wanted to support the things that he had been doing, and I felt like it was maybe a safe investment from that perspective. But more than anything, just from a being involved in the community, it just felt like a really fun thing to do. I don't know if I'd call it fun at this point. the restaurant business, I don't know about you, you'd ever call the restaurant business fun. But it is rewarding. There's a lot of fulfillment. There's moments of fulfillment that I've not experienced in most of the other parts of my life. But it is very difficult. But yeah, it's been a really fulfilling experience so far.
Now, you did a substantial remodel. Why did you have to do it? How big a deal was it? And how long did you have to stay closed?
Well, it was a very big deal. The Hub had been around originally since 1933. It had burned down. In fact, a close customer of ours, Mr. Jerry Christensen, phenomenal guy, as we were actually tearing down the restaurant, he brought us a poster. And that poster is from the original reopening in the 60s after it had burned down. And it's this really great flyer we have in the back of our restaurant. And it's been through many hands. The reason we needed to tear it down, and it was a very perplexing challenge to deal with, because it had given all it had to give. And the bones were tired, the nervous system was shot, and you couldn't just put a new coat of paint on anymore. Because it had to kind of be done right to survive another 100 years. And so as we'd peel off, you know, oh, the paint's bubbling, we know there's been a, you know, water damage here, you take that off, oh, the sheetrock's bad, you take the sheetrock's off, oh, the studs are all, you know, worn out and busted out. And so it became a substantial remodel. I mean, to be frank, it would have cost substantially less to just tear it down and rebuild it. But because of the history, you don't want to do that. You know, even just psychologically, if you drive by and a bulldozer's knocked it down, it's not the Hub anymore. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to lose that. That was very important because there is so much history there. And so we were very conscious about the spaces. Like if you come into the Hub and you look to the right, there's a room back there. It was called the card room. And there's a lot of stories of people having events in their life in the card room. And so it's today still a separate room, but we have it in windows now, so it's open and not so closed off, but it's still a room so you can still connect to those events that you had there. Even the booths in the main dining area, it would have been far more efficient from just kind of a rear ends and seat standpoint to just do more like table seating. But we even to this day have a lot of people come in and tell us stories about, hey, I used to sit in that booth with my grandpa every fall when we would come up to go hunting. And so we don't want to lose the connection to that history. So the booths are in the exact same spots as they were. Our larger room in back, you know, that was closed off. It didn't have windows, so it felt kind of dark and heavy. We wanted to change that feeling, but we didn't want to change the room. So, you know, we've now got large windows in there to kind of bring in the light, a really nice fireplace. We've added an outdoor dining area with the patio. That'll be year-round seating. And so, you know, we've tried to be very intentional with the space so that we don't lose the history, but also in a way that we've given it new bones, a new nervous system, and put it in a place that hopefully it now can last another 100 years.
That's great. What differences, well, you've talked about the differences we can expect. What remains the same?
Well, I hope that the number one thing that's remained the same is the feeling. We want people to come. We want them to feel a sense of not just good food, but shelter and home and feeling like this is your place, especially for our locals. We want them to feel like they have a place to call their own. But we also recognize that Heber has grown and changed, and, you know, and the pros and cons of that will be debated, you know, into infinity. But nonetheless, we have to support those in town, and so we want to. We've been very intentional in how we're trying to support that local feel of comfort and love and a local place to be, but trying to support everyone that's in town.
Devin, we got about 30 seconds left. Tell me your most popular dish.
Well, our steaks are extremely popular. We're quickly becoming known for our steaks. Our breakfast is really phenomenal. We have the waffles are probably the most popular. I prefer our huevos rancheros in the morning, but I would say our steaks are probably becoming the most popular thing we have.
Devin Johnson, thanks for spending time with us. We'll be right back after this.